Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
The Entity List. A bland, bureaucratic name, beneath which lies a powerful tool to protect U.S. national security. The Entity List is essentially a blacklist. When the government puts an organization on the list, it effectively bans that company from doing business in the United States and prohibits American companies from selling to the blacklisted organization. It's used to penalize companies, for example, that violate sanctions. But the entity list can also be used when there is, quote, reasonable cause to believe that the entity has been involved in activities that are contrary to the national security or foreign policy interests of the United States, end quote. Well, recently the Biden administration added four new companies to the entity list. They are cyber companies that sell spyware. The spyware has been used by various governments to hack journalists, activists, and now, reportedly, U.S. diplomats. But the Biden administration took an additional, unusual step. Three of those companies now blacklisted are based in allied countries.
The industry itself is currently unregulated and in its current form pretty ungovernable. And as a result, is starting to create casualties, not just for human rights groups and others, but also to the diplomatic priorities of a close ally, namely Israel.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. When cybersecurity is national security, what are the obligations of U.S. allies to protect the United States from the threat of cyber attack? Well, one of the companies newly blacklisted by the Biden administration is called the NSO Group. The company is based in Israel and reportedly has ties to Israel's legendary intelligence agency, Unit 8200, considered equivalent to the NSA here in the U.S. The NSO Group created the now notorious Pegasus spyware that can be covertly installed on almost any mobile phone. NSO says it sells software to governments mostly for law enforcement use to, quote, help them combat terror and crime. But the spyware, as mentioned, has also been used on human rights activists and journalists. And this month, the first known case of Pegasus reportedly being used against American officials surfaced in Uganda, where the iPhones of 11 U.S. embassy officials were reportedly hacked. So what happens when Pegasus spyware worms its way onto a phone? Szabolcs Pányi is a Hungarian journalist based in Budapest. In 2019, Pányi was investigating a Russian bank that was relocating to Budapest. The bank may have been a front for Russian intelligence activities, so he was looking into why Hungarian President Viktor Orbán didn't seem to take the potential risk seriously. Though Pányi didn't realize it at the time, he now knows the exact day his phone was hacked.
It was 2019, I think April the 4th. And on April the 6th, I was having a meeting with an American journalist who came to Hungary to investigate the very same institution. It's called the International Investment Bank. And I was having a meeting with this American journalist in Budapest. And on that day, Pegasus was again activated on my phone. And later we also found out that the Hungarian fixer, a photojournalist working for this American reporter, so the fixer's phone number was also targeted with a Pegasus spyware. By 2019, Pegasus was equipped with what they call a zero-click attack, meaning that I was not even aware that the spyware has targeted and infiltrated my phone. There were different attacks. One came through iMessage. And basically what happened is that there was either a call or a message coming through iMessage that instantly deleted itself. So I was not even aware of this contact, but it was enough for the attackers to plant certain files on my phone. My phone was not slower than usual. The battery was not draining faster than usual. So I had no knowledge of this. In a 7 months period, those who surveilled me were hacking into my phone multiple times every other week, every other month, and they could have possibly accessed everything on my phone, even my Signal and WhatsApp messages, my calendars, my emails, photos, videos, everything. And I was told that basically my whole life, which is of course on my phone, as with anyone else, that my whole life was like an open book.
Pawnee did not know he'd been hacked until earlier this year. He was in his newsroom when he got a call from two well-known German investigative reporters. Bastian Obermeier and Frederick Obermeier are the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters at the heart of the Panama Papers, a series of stories that exposed the dark global system of financial offshoring. They'd been leaked another database, this one with thousands of telephone numbers that had been the target for hacking by the Pegasus spyware. The numbers included 14 heads of state, including French President Emmanuel Macron and Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan. There were hundreds of journalists' phone numbers, too, among them Pawnee's. Later on, Amnesty International analyzed his phone and confirmed that it had been infected with Pegasus spyware.
My whole year in 2021 was mostly about Pegasus, and I'm still working on stories of other targets, try to identify other people who were illegally surveilled. And, you know, the biggest concern is how can I protect my sources after this? And that's the biggest problem, because, you know, of course my privacy was invaded very brutally with this software, but also my right to protect my sources has been infringed.
Let's recall, Pawnee had been investigating Hungarian President Viktor Orbán's lack of urgency around the risks of a Russian bank that had links to Russian intelligence relocating to Budapest. NSO Group, the makers of the Pegasus spyware, has done business with more than three dozen governments around the world. Among them, the Hungarian government. A senior official has admitted that they have purchased Pegasus from the NSO Group.
And that's the most concerning, because those people who risk the most are those who provide us with sensitive information about corruption and other types of wrongdoings, abuses of power. And if they cannot trust us, if they cannot trust that, you know, what they tell us won't get them into trouble, then they would just, you know, stop contacting journalists and stop leaking this type of information. So the chilling effect is real, and I already experienced that. You know, some people just don't want to sit down with me. Some sources that were willing to talk are now just absent, and they just disappeared. But you know, that's life. At least Hungary is still an EU member state, and although a failing one, but the red line of using force against journalists or physically threatening journalists, it has not been crossed yet. So I think I'm lucky.
Szabolcs Pawnee. He's a Hungarian journalist based in Budapest. So that Pegasus spyware is indeed out in the wild. And as we mentioned earlier, it originates from a U.S. ally, namely Israel, and that NSO group. Another U.S. ally, or a country that the Americans have diplomatic ties with, Singapore. And another one of the recently blacklisted cyber companies is based in Singapore as well. So let's turn now to John Scott Railton. He's senior researcher at Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto. He focuses on technological threats to civil society. And several years ago, he and a colleague first uncovered the systematic use of Pegasus spyware to target civil society in several countries. John Scott Railton, welcome to you.
Hello, Magna.
So first of all, tell us, regarding that Pegasus spyware, do we know the extent of how much it has been used and against whom?
Well, we don't really know the full extent of how it's been used, but we do know that increasingly, wherever we scratch, we find it. For every case of abuse that we find, we're sure that there are tens to hundreds of others, which speaks directly to the problem of the industry, which is its business is conducted in secrecy, and so is its hacking, which means that many of its harms are deliberately hidden from notice, from the victims, and from any kind of discovery. It's why it's so important that it be investigated and researched by independent third parties, but also why regulation has lagged so long behind the actual harms that are being created. They're simply hidden.
So we'll talk a little bit more about what impact the placement of NSO Group on the U.S. entity list might have. But John, how would you describe overall what the global threat of this spyware is? Spyware that's sold to governments.
We're going towards a place where almost every country in the world is going to obtain the ability to unaccountably hack anyone else anywhere in the world. It's a tremendously destabilizing thing to think about, and we're already seeing the beginnings of consequences. Of course, for years, human rights workers and journalists were kind of the canaries in the proverbial digital coal mine as autocrat after autocrat chose to hack them. Increasingly, we're seeing that governments, too, are being targeted with this kind of technology. And some people might say, well, but isn't it fair game? One government hacks another government. Maybe. But we're going to a place where every government is going to do it and is going to have this capability. And to me, that looks a lot like a really problematic proliferation. And I'm not the only one. Clearly, the U.S. government and others feel the same way.
And they do, and they're making more noise about it now. I should just note, though, that regarding the reported use of Pegasus on the phones of U.S. diplomats in Uganda, NSO Group says it had no awareness of the attacks and in a statement said, quote, the company is committed to human rights and the protection of the national security and safety of the U.S. and its allies. We have about 30 seconds before the break, John. Your response to that?
Well, I think if NSO was really concerned about the security of the U.S. and its allies, it would have taken action. For example, it could have taken action in 2019 when there was already public reporting that Pegasus was being used against U.S. allies. The fact that they didn't take decisive action then indicates exactly how seriously they take the security of the U.S. and its allies.
So this hour, we're talking about the fact that cybersecurity is national security, and how does that complicate matters when some cybersecurity threats, officially now identified by the Biden administration, are emerging from allied nations? We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today we're talking about the entity list. More specifically, what happens when cybersecurity is national security and some of the biggest cybersecurity threats globally may be emerging from American allies? What are the responsibilities, the obligation that those diplomatic ties present for those allies in terms of protecting or helping to protect American national security? I'm joined today by John Scott Railton. He's senior researcher at Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto and a bunch of years ago was one of the first people to identify the widespread use of Pegasus spyware made by the NSO Group in Israel. And I'd like to bring in now Steve Feldstein. He's senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and author of The Rise of Digital Repression, How Technology is Reshaping Power, Politics, and Resistance. Steve, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me on, Meg.
So first of all, give us what the Biden administration has said about why it's added these four new cyber companies, and specifically the three that come from both Israel and Singapore, to the entity list. It's not strictly a national security argument the Biden administration's making.
Yeah, they've actually presented two arguments, and they've categorized the four companies into two sort of categories. So first, with regard to NSO Group and Candyroo, which are based in Israel, they said that they were placed on the entity list because they were responsible for conducting transnational repression, which is the practice of authoritarian governments targeting dissidents, journalists, and activists. So they specifically laid out human rights-based criteria as reasons for placing those two companies on the entity list. Now, for Positive Technologies from Russia and Computer Security Initiative Consultancy from Singapore, they were a little, the justification was a little different. They said they trafficked in cyber tools to gain unauthorized access to information systems threatening privacy and security of individuals. And so, you know, really what's interesting is that for the first two, there's a direct human rights linkage that was made. For the others, there is a little more, it's a little less explicit.
And that human rights linkage, though, is the Biden administration also saying that because it has a focus on human rights, that therefore there's a connection to U.S. national security? That's the part I'm not clear on.
Yeah, well, they say national security and foreign policy interests. Uh-huh. Whether it's human rights directly as national security, which some would argue it should be, or whether it's more on the foreign policy side, either way, they believe there is an important connection that essentially transacting and transnational repression targeting journalists and activists and so forth does relate, at least broadly speaking, to U.S. foreign policy interests.
So, John Scott Railton, let me turn back to you on this. What do you make of this designation? Because I could also imagine the Biden administration, if it were to feel so bold, to come out and say, look, we know that companies like NSO Group sell to other governments. And once their spyware is out there, it's impossible to control how it's used. So therefore, de facto, it's a U.S. national security threat. But they didn't quite say that.
Well, it sounds to me like they're working in that direction. And it's really important to look at this designation as two things. One, it has direct impact on certain business practices. But two, it's also a signal sent to NSO's investors and to the industry and to the state of Israel about the Biden administration's displeasure and where things are going. I think you have a new administration that's working its way towards more regulation.
Okay, so tell us more about these investors, because I know you call it a mercenary spyware marketplace. Who's investing in it?
Well, the thing that's a bit bananas is here's a foreign company who is enabling hacking and human rights abuses around the world, and the biggest investors and their owner include the Oregon Public Employee Retirement System and the Alaskan Permanent Fund. So the investors are actually pretty close to home for us, and that speaks to the fact that the hacking industry more broadly has sought major international investment, offering a lot of profits. I think we're hopefully beginning to see a bit of a corrective where the investors realize just how misaligned some of these hacking companies may be with their priorities and their basic ethical responsibilities, but also the bottom line as companies like NSO begin to twist in the wind a little bit.
Okay. Steve Feldstein, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think that, you know, certainly the signal that is sent when it comes to NSO Group being placed on the entity list is something that the industry will take very seriously. I think what's also interesting, too, is that NSO Group is an important player, but it's by far not the only player, either when it comes to being an Israeli-based spyware company or, more broadly, companies based in other countries. And so, to that extent, it's a good start. It sends a signal. But really, there's a lot more work to be done when it comes to the wider industry and the types of conduct, behavioral conduct, that they will propagate.
Yeah, so I want to get to that because that's important, sort of what to do next here. But you know, I'd like to dig in a little bit more with you, Steve, for a moment about how spyware, and again, just focusing on Pegasus for a little bit longer, has been used against human rights activists and journalists. I mean, we should mention that I believe, if I remember correctly, Pegasus was found on the phone of murdered Saudi Arabian or murdered the journalist Jamal Khashoggi, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, that's my understanding. John probably knows this more specifically than me, but you know, a wide range of dissidents, political opposition, journalists, human rights activists, and so forth. You know, really anyone who would look to be a challenge to a particular regime. And you can name your favorite authoritarian country, chances are they're using spyware from NSO Group or another company like it. That's a very common and I think really distressing pattern that we see.
Yeah, John, go ahead. Tell us more, because I'd love to hear in detail like the cases that we know about.
Yeah, well, so on the case of Jamal Khashoggi, what we know is that people around him, from his closest collaborators, like a Canadian named Omar Abdulaziz, his wife, his fiance, other family members, were all targeted with Pegasus. And so although Jamal's phone is not currently in the possession of researchers, those around him certainly have been. And it's very clear that there was this like lead up of targeting around and before his murder. And that's not the only time that there's the intersection of Pegasus and murder. For example, several years ago, Javier Valdez, a Mexican publisher who reported on the nexus of official corruption and cartels in Mexico, was brutally assassinated and his devices taken. But immediately after his assassination, first his colleagues and then his partner were targeted by Pegasus. And versions of that story repeat themselves again and again. This is a powerful and secretive tool. And in the hands of unaccountable security services and autocrats, it's just going to keep getting used again and again and again. In the last couple of weeks, we've seen even more cases of abuses linked to Pegasus come forth. And I think we're just going to probably see more before the end of the year is out.
What are those cases in the last couple of weeks?
Well, just yesterday, we learned, for example, that a number of activists from Kazakhstan were targeted with Pegasus based on analysis by Amnesty International's tech lab. This is just kind of like the beginning of the story. Similarly, Citizen Lab and others have continued to investigate cases. What was really dramatic is that over the summer, something different happened, which was there was this thing called the Pegasus Project, where a group of journalists operating under the umbrella of something called Forbidden Stories really began.
John? We're going to get him back in a second. Steve Feldstein, let me turn back to you here. And again, focusing on the fact that human rights is sort of the one of the first justifications that the Biden administration has used to put these companies on the entity list. Do you think that's actually significant? Because I imagine that human rights activists and journalists for a long time have been saying, look, the cyber threats are real. We're suffering from them already, but perhaps we're not paid as close attention to as they are now.
Yeah, I think it's meaningful. And I also think that there's no coincidence that it's time for the President Biden's Democracy Summit, which is taking place yesterday and today. You know, in my conversations with different U.S. government officials and my dealings with the human rights community, for years, there's been raised alarms about the type of spyware, how it's being used, and its really detrimental effect to civil society activists and many others. And I think there have been steps and a recognition that more needs to be done to regulate this industry, but it's been slow going in terms of actually taking real, tangible, concrete measures to do financial damage, which is essentially what being on the entity list will do to some of the major players. And I do think that the Pegasus project in particular and the public backlash that resulted finally helped force the hand of the Biden administration, which was already leaning in this direction, but said, wait, this is something that should be a priority.
So the Pegasus Project, as you referred to, is the reporting that came out from multiple news organizations about how the widespread use of Pegasus. And John Scott Railton, I think we have you back. Is that correct?
I think so, too.
I'm going to resist the urge, or maybe not, to say maybe you got cut off by something like Pegasus. But
anything is possible, which is why this stuff is so terrifying.
Now, you were in the middle of giving us some examples of just recent cases where people had activists or journalists had been targeted by Pegasus. Go ahead and finish.
Well, so one of the most interesting things about the last couple of months is that we're really beginning to be able to tell the world just how diverse the cast of characters of targets are. So since 2016, Citizen Lab and others like Amnesty International have been really bringing to the world the fact that activists and human rights defenders get targeted with Pegasus. In recent years, partly thanks to the Pegasus Project, partly thanks to governments starting to really get prickly about this stuff, we're beginning to learn a lot more about some of the other kinds of categories of people who get targeted. They include diplomats, of course, and government personnel. Of course, one of the things that is kind of interesting about this whole problem is the narrative that NSO and the industry make is this is a tool for tracking terrorists and serious criminals. The reality, though, is that it's a tool that states wind up using for a lot of different purposes, whether it's targeting journalists or diplomats or political opponents or personal enemies. All of those kinds of targets are on the table, and we're seeing that again and again. I want to flag something interesting, which is this September, every owner of an Apple device got an update. That was to close what's called a zero-click vulnerability that was found in iMessage. That discovery came because a rather brave human rights defender shared the contents of their device with my colleague Bill Marzak and the Citizen Lab, and we found the beginnings of this extremely sophisticated exploit, which Apple then worked to close. What's interesting about that case is that since that time, Apple has not only closed the exploit and technically pushed some protection out to its users, but actually sued NSO Group and come out very publicly in doing so and notified all these victims. And it speaks to another component of this conversation, which I hope we can talk about more, which is big tech platforms have become completely fed up with NSO Group, in part because it can't just be solved with technical means of control. It also has to be addressed in the courts. And Apple is now the second major company to sue NSO Group for the hacking of its users.
Okay. So here, this brings us really to the heart of what I want to explore this hour, because the existence of this mercenary spyware industry, as you call it, John, and now the well-documented attacks on activist journalists and reportedly now U.S. diplomats, the placement of these companies on the entity list. The wrinkle, of course, that's in plain sight is that, as we mentioned earlier, some of these companies are based in allied countries, in countries that we have very close relationships with. So we'll hear a little bit more later about exactly the relationship between NSO Group and the Israeli government. But Steve Feldstein, I mean, does the Israeli government have an obligation to do more to curtail the activities of countries that the United States, or of companies, I should say, that the United States now has essentially designated as a threat to human rights and U.S. national security?
Yeah, I would think so. And I think there are sort of two ways in which to approach this. So one, you could sort of say, what are the human rights obligations that Israel has when it comes to circumscribing the use of these tools towards really damaging human rights outcomes? And on that, those grounds alone, I think you could make a pretty strong case that Israel should do a lot more to narrow and to really control and manage the use and proliferation of these tools. You can also certainly make a national security / foreign policy argument as well, that this is now turning into a real threat in terms of undermining other governments and their officials, or undermining U.S. diplomats and others as well. And so they kind of bleed into one another, that certainly the human rights component is one that we think a lot about and I think gets a lot of the headlines, but increasingly we're becoming aware of the broader proliferation and bleeding over into national security issues as well, all of which is of concern to the Biden administration.
John Scott Railton, I imagine that given what politics are in Washington, making overt demands of Israel is kind of a non-starter. But is the placement of NSO on the entity list perhaps sort of a more subtle diplomatic way for the U.S. to try to be nudging Tel Aviv?
Well, in a way, it is subtle, although I'll point out that the Israeli press, since that designation, has been just full of stories of the industry kind of losing its mind and really worrying just how big the consequences are going to be. And when that was coupled just a few weeks later with this major legal action and like victim notification by Apple, it seems like the Israeli offensive industry is really trying to figure out where to go next and probably demanding that the Israeli state have their back.
And so meaning what, though?
Well, I think what's happening now is that for years the industry has operated, including the offensive industry out of Israel, with a kind of a narrative of being aligned with Israel's broader foreign policy priorities. And in fact, according to a lot of reporting, the industry's deals may partially reflect, in some case, soft power choices by Israel. Once upon a time, if you were making a diplomatic relationship with a country, what they wanted from you was maybe weapons. Now what they want is cyber weapons. And so the offensive industry, the hacking industry, the mercenary surveillance industry lives right within that box. And I think what we're beginning to see is a situation where the industry's own lack of regulation and growth has its own misalignments with other foreign policy priorities of the Israeli government. And the Israeli government is now I think, trying to sort of struggle to limit the impact on its industry and try to somehow get out from under the problem that they're currently facing, which is it really looks like the U.S. has very seriously expressed some displeasure and the industry is cruising for more regulatory action.
Okay, so Steve Feldstein, is this a cautionary tale of be careful what you create?
I think that's right. And I think there's sort of two points that come to mind for me. So first of all, we actually know that the Israeli government itself is directly petitioning the U.S. government to reconsider placing NSO Group on the entity list. So this has been reported by a number of news outlets, but this is not something that is subtle. This is something that is out there and has been leaked publicly in terms of the Israeli government's displeasure about this action. And so that, I think, tells you a lot in terms of this close nexus between the government and these companies. I think what the second interesting thing as well is that in my own field of research, going to and talking to different intelligence officers around the world in places like Thailand and the Philippines, what we found out, what we know, is that Israeli spyware companies are very aggressive on the ground in terms of peddling their products. And that kind of aggression, especially when it comes to working with authoritarian countries, I think has led to the type of damages that we're also concerned about.
Well, we are talking this hour about when cybersecurity is national security and what complications that presents when some of the world's most potent spyware is coming from allied nations. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a close look at a thing called the Entity List. And why? Well, it's a list where the United States government essentially blacklists countries for being a threat to U.S. national security, being a threat to human rights. And the Biden administration recently put four cybersecurity companies on that list, three of which are based in allied countries. And we're talking about whether that presents a wrinkle regarding the diplomatic or allied obligations that nations have to each other when it comes to being the home base for companies that are threats to cybersecurity. I'm joined today by John Scott Railton. He's a senior researcher at Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto. He focuses on technological threats to civil society. And back in 2016, he and a colleague first revealed how much the Pegasus spyware was being used around the world. Steve Feldstein also joins us. He's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and author of The Rise of Digital Repression: How Technology is Reshaping Power, Politics, and Resistance. And John and Steve, I want to just dive much more deeply into Israel's response to NSO Group being put on the entity list and the relationship between the group itself and the Israeli government. So in order to understand that better, we reached out to Yaakov Katz, editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post and author of Shadow Strike, Inside Israel's Secret Mission to Eliminate Syrian Nuclear Power. And Katz told us that the U.S. government putting the NSO Group on the entity list has, in effect, put Israel on notice.
What we need to remember in the context of all of this, because what someone could say, and the Israeli government tried to make this argument at one point, is that NSO is a private company. And as a private company, we're not responsible for what they do. But that's not true, because like any other defense company in Israel, for a defense contractor to be able to sell its weapons, platforms, technology anywhere in the world, it needs to receive an export license from the Israeli Defense Ministry. And the same holds true for NSO. And therefore, if NSO is selling its technology to country X, that means that the Israeli government is basically giving the approval for NSO to do so.
Now, Katz says it's safe to assume there's been some coordination and diplomatic discussion about the blacklisting of the NSO group between Tel Aviv and Washington. But historically, he told us that the Israeli government hasn't said much publicly about NSO, though privately it has organized some damage control in the past. As Katz reports in the Jerusalem Post, when it was discovered that French President Emmanuel Macron's phone was reportedly hacked by Pegasus spyware, Defense Minister Benny Gantz flew to Paris to patch things up, end quote. Well, now, with the NSO group on the U.S. entity list, Katz says the Israeli government has taken more action.
Firstly, what it did was it minimized or cut down the country list that NSO or any cyber company is allowed to export to. So instead of being something like 100 countries, now it's down to just a few dozen. And the second step that they took was that they want more scrutiny and control over the end user. So it's not enough for me to say I'm selling my weapons and my technology to Nicaragua, let's just say, right, or Rwanda. But I also need to know, okay, once it's there, who's using it? What's it being used for? And that gives you a little more control to be able to say, okay, this is something that I don't condone, and I'm not going to let you use the technology to spy on U.S. diplomats like we saw in Africa somewhere, or to crack down on journalists or other political opposition leaders. So I think it is being done in good faith. To tell you that these steps would have been taken without the U.S. blacklisting of NSO, I don't think so, right? That was the wake-up call. That's what prompted all of this. It's not as if Israel would have done it anyhow.
Now, recently, Katz wrote in the Jerusalem Post, and he posited a different scenario. He asked, quote, imagine for a moment Israel Aerospace Industries, the government-owned weapons company, which is known to supply missiles to Azerbaijan. Well, what would have happened had a drone or an Israeli-sold missile landed on an Armenian school and killed dozens of children? Would Israel have been able to pretend that it had nothing to do with it? Would it have been able to hide behind statements that IAI is a private company? Well, of course not, Katz writes. So he goes on and he says, if Israel admits to allowing the sale of cyber weapons, then it would be held accountable for the way those weapons are used. It would need to answer questions that would lead to more calls, like Amnesty International's, to limit the sale and use of those weapons.
To assume that you can just sell your technology without any accountability in today's world, working with this administration, this is not the Trump administration, it's a different administration, and therefore Israel needs to be more sensitive to the way this administration looks at human rights, looks at civil liberties, looks at the way some countries that are not necessarily democratic might crack down on political dissidents and use this technology to do so. And Israel needs to be to understand that this is a new playground. And if it wants to retain that strong alliance with the United States, it's going to have to play by new rules.
So what might happen as a result of NSO's designation on the entity list? Well, Katz says that depends on what the Israeli government decides to do next.
I think that the first and foremost thing that Israel needs to do is stop pretending that this isn't something that has to do with the government, right? And to start to fess up and understand that what's happening here actually involves the government and requires of the government to be a little more active and to create more oversight over what's happening. I think what it also needs to do is to come clean to the Americans and to explain exactly what it's doing and how it's taking these steps and actions to try to contain or to control a little more where this technology is going, and to make sure that these steps that they've announced with tighter export controls are real and is not just some facade and a fake presentation to show people that they're doing something when they're not actually doing something. They have to take this more seriously. And I hope that this will be that wake-up call.
That's Yaakov Katz, editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. Now, John Scott Railton, I've used the phrase ties between NSO and the Israeli government, which is a journalistic shorthand that's almost meaningless, I'll admit. How much do we know about what the relationship actually is between the Israeli government and NSO group?
Well, I think Katz makes some interesting points. And what he highlights, of course, is that there's pretty clearly a very close nexus between the Israeli government and players like NSO Group, and that is really perhaps partly the X factor that has allowed NSO to cruise for so long, contributing so much to global cyber insecurity without facing consequences. I want to just push back a little bit on something that Katz said, which is he suggested that, you know, there were some serious steps being taken by Israel, including limitations of certain numbers of sort of countries where this could be sold and more due diligence. And I would just point out that a number of Israeli commentators and experts have suggested that actually those limitations just refer to which countries you could sell to while needing a special permit. Mm. And moreover, that the due diligence requirements mostly involve asking dictators to certify that they won't abuse technology. Both of those things sound to me like very uncertain quantities, and I think it's much too early to say whether any of them will really have bite. At the end of the day, though, like Katz, I agree, it comes down to governmental priorities. I think the situation in Israel is further complicated by the fact that many former Israeli security officials turn right around and work for NSO when they leave their posts. And this suggests that there may be kind of like a troubling knot of interests that point in different directions and that make it uniquely hard to regulate this industry. It's a problem that we have in the United States, too, when former government officials are too close to defense contractors. I think it points to cybersecurity and cyber defense as being kind of the next frontier for many countries in untangling those complicated and problematic knots of interests.
Steve Feldstein, Yaakov Katz is also, you know, in his Jerusalem Post editorial, he wrote about how the Israeli government has been in the past pretty forthright in its defense of NSO group within Israel, in part because of something that you said, that the Israeli defense establishment wants to be able to use NSO's products for its own purposes, and that kind of I can't remember if it was you or John, so forgive me, but leverage the products for international diplomatic gain. So beyond the placement on the entities list, I'm not sure where I see the levers to help further regulate or control the use of this the spyware.
Well, you know, I think that they can certainly make choices and that there's a nuance. It's not simply allow NSO Group to operate business as usual, sell to whomever, whatever countries it would like, have minimal human rights controls and due diligence, or ban them completely. I think the whole idea behind a well-regulated and accountable industry, if it's possible to get there, and that's something I think certainly the Israeli government needs to take seriously, is to follow some of the best practices and guidelines that already are established when it comes to business and human rights. And to that sense, you know, have end user monitoring, be able to pull back, claw back this technology when there are abuses that occur. Ahead of time, look and say, is there a reasonable or foreseeable likelihood that this technology will be abused by a particular government? I think there are ways to get through these tricky issues.
Can't we just, aren't we living in an age where we just need to assume de facto from the start, sorry, that we just need to assume that the technologies will be abused? I mean, it's spyware. It's not meant to like do necessarily good, depending on, you know, who you are. But you see what I'm saying? Like, I just feel like we have to assume from the start. So given that, Steve, what do we... How can we, you know, you're talking about clawbacks or end user stuff. How does that actually work?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think maybe a good analogy is looking at something else like the arms control industry. You know, you can assume proliferation. You can assume that in many cases there will be bad use. At the same time, having controls, having an oversight structure that makes choices, and also understanding that there are different levels of sophistication. So some of the tools at NSO Group is peddling, particularly its zero-click exploits, are some of the most advanced tools in the world when it comes to spyware. So finding a way to manage that, to bring about more accountability, to think about solutions, and not just to say, well, everyone will get it, so throw our hands up. I think that's the way forward.
John Scott Railton would love to hear you on this.
Well, you know, you bring up this point, like it's spyware, and you're absolutely right. It is spyware, and it's totally terrifying. And what really keeps me up at night is something we haven't yet touched on, but I want to just flag it here for everyone who's listening. The business model of so many companies, NSO included, is not to finish their days selling to autocrats. It's to spend years honing their tech, selling in autocratic regimes, so that they can eventually put it in the hands of every Western police force they can make connections with, including regional and municipal police. And that terrifies me. we have a problem in general in the United States and elsewhere with the oversight of police activities. And NSO's very clearly defined business interests, including opening up business fronts in the United States, has been to push this tech to local police. We know that some American police departments have even gotten demos and trials of NSO's technology. That is beyond scary because for me, we do know something about this technology, which is that it has baked in abuse potential, and lacking really tight oversight, it's just a matter of time before it gets abused. The idea that like an LAPD, for example, is wielding this cross-border ability to silently and secretly and unaccountably hack phones is terrifying. And it's why the other reason why we in democracies should care, it's not just something about what's happening overseas, it's something that might eventually happen to us.
Okay, so we've got about three-ish minutes left here. It seems to me that the placement of these companies on the entity list, on the federal government's entity list, is a start, right? For all the reasons we talked about. It's putting, for example, the Israeli government on notice a little bit. It may have some minor business impact on NSO Group because of the blacklisting here in the United States. But you said something even more important, that the abuse potential is baked in. So we need to have, going in the future, tight oversight and control. So, John, what does that look like? What does that mean?
Well, I think in general, 2020, 2021, we're living in a digital hell of our own making because we've allowed technologies to proliferate across society before there's any kind of meaningful understanding on how to control and regulate them. And the same thing is on its way to happening with the spyware industry. We get out of this in a couple ways. One is really serious regulation on the part of countries that are selling this stuff, right? If it's getting abused, it shouldn't be going to those countries. If those countries are known and notorious abusers, they shouldn't be being able to buy it. It also means that you shouldn't really be able to sell it in a country that doesn't yet have serious oversight for use. Otherwise, you can just guarantee that you're almost fueling and encouraging the development of authoritarianism in those countries. It's not an accident, for example, that where this country has entered Europe, like in Hungary, where this technology has entered Europe, it's being abused for autocratic reasons. It's also the case, and this is really critical, that people who are coming out of security and intelligence services be very closely scrutinized for what they do in their business activities afterwards. Otherwise, and we see it with the United States too, former NSA people going to help the UAE building hacking capabilities that wind up getting pointed at Americans. This really needs to be addressed as well. I'm going to stop there because others may have things to say.
Well, Steve Feldstein, it makes me wonder if, I mean, what John's calling for is a kind of global coordination around the threat of cyber attack. Could the United States sort of put a little bit more muscle into that? Would you suggest the United States even consider, I don't know, using sanctions as a way to push countries a little bit more?
Absolutely. I think that's precisely the right way to go. I think what we're talking about is the building of a global norm that discourages the use of spyware, except in very exceptional circumstances with appropriate controls. And actually, one of the interesting things that the Biden administration just announced yesterday as part of the Summit for Democracy is a new export controls and human rights initiative, which has a goal of regulating dual-use technology, particularly spyware. So you already can see that there is this emerging norm. It builds on some of the actions that took place in terms of placing NSO Group on the entity list. And to the extent that a wider group of democracies and countries will work to put in place the type of strictures and controls that we've mentioned, I think that'll get us to, I don't know, a good place, but a slightly better place, more manageable place when it comes to this technology.
But of course, hypocrisy reigns supreme, and the U.S. would have to also look inward and apply those same regulations and controls on companies here in the United States, because we're talking about global spyware, the mercenary spyware industry, as John Scott Railton calls it. John, senior researcher at Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto, it has been so great to have you. Thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us today.
Magda, it's been a pleasure.
And Steve Feldstein, senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the Rise of Digital Repression, How Technology is Reshaping Power, Politics, and Resistance. Same to you, Steve. Thank you for your work, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Magda.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.